You're listening to the Flasco Oncopod, brought to you by the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, the voice of oncology in Florida.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Mayan Hussain. I'm a medical oncologist hematologist with Florida Cancer Specialist, the current president of Florida Society of Clinical Oncology. I'm honored today to have two distinguished gentlemen here with me today. Dr. Michael Jagwal, he's a hematologist at Moffitt Cancer Center, and Dr. Jorge Garcia from Baptist Hospital. Dr. Garcia, he's the Assistant Vice President, System Oncology Infusion and Investigation of Drug Pharmacy Services. He have other lines of also titles, but I'll just stop here. So we can go ahead. Today, we're going to talk about paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. PNH is the other name, as we all know it as PNH. It's a disease that in your career as a hematologist, you might see two or three patients. If you're a specialist, you might see more because you get the referrals. So we're looking forward to hear from you guys more about this disease and know what are the best practices in diagnosis and in treatment of this disease. So I think the way we start, the issue with this disease, you know, when I went to medical school, PNH was, okay, you urinate blood at night. I mean, that's what basically it means for paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. It's not all the time. But now we understand that this is really a systemic disease that affects almost every organ in the body. And definitely, sometimes the presentation may not be bleeding urine at night, urinating blood at night. So, you know, around 24% of diagnosis can take up to 5 years before we reach a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So I'll start with you, Dr. How do you think you see those patients? What in your mind would you say, like, I wish we'd have this, you know, referring physician or someone have done this first, we would have reached a diagnosis first. What is the best way to reach a diagnosis? What is
so,
this way?
So like you suggested, you know, the delay in diagnosis is a impediment in this disease. Definitely, you know, there are some subgroups such as, you know, in your aplastic anemia patients, in your myelodysplastic patients, that you should definitely check for PNH, your Coombs negative hemolytic anemia patients, your unusual thrombosis patients, and your patients with, as you mentioned, maybe unexplained iron deficiency anemia, mm-hmm. As a result of the hemoglobinuria, maybe your patients with abdominal pain and unusual thrombosis, such as portal vein thrombosis and hemolysis, like we said, you know, your Coombs negative hemolysis. So I think, you know, that's a broad area to test, but it's important to test. It's an easy test. Mm-hmm. You know, once you think about it, you can't diagnose something you don't think about. So you should definitely have it in your differential diagnosis for these disorders, and hence you can come up with a diagnosis. You know, unlike some other diseases, this is an easy test to order, flow cytometry for PNH.
And it's from the blood, right?
And it's from the peripheral blood.
Blood. Yeah.
So you don't need a bone marrow to get your diagnosis here. So it's very important to think about the diagnosis, and once you think about it, you can definitely diagnose these people, and it's easily treated. And Dr. Garcia, do you have any additions?
Well, thank you both. I would say in our health system, when we think about this patient population, we're trying to first, to your point, identify these patients, and that's first top of mind. We know that we try to get to these patients as early as possible. We're really looking at 12 to 13 patients per million in the population. So that early diagnosis becomes top of mind and really a priority for us. Secondly, once that patient is already established and is diagnosed, we really try to think about what's the best access that we can provide to that patient. And we think about that, you know, access on the inpatient setting to therapy options, but also access to that patient on the outpatient setting too. So on our inpatient setting, that early initiation we know leads to the best patient outcomes, and it also leads to efficiencies within that hospital stay. So we've educated our teams to make sure that for those patients that present acutely and may need to start treatment on the inpatient side, that we not only make the therapy available, but that we make it available as soon as possible. So those patients could be well managed, stabilized, and then transition to the outpatient setting for maintenance treatment there. Once those patients come to the outpatient setting, it's a very important stage of the treatment for us because these patients do require treatment long-term. And so making sure that we have good access from an outpatient setting, specifically to the therapy options, is really, really important. In our experience, we have seen a lot of PNH patients that have had infusion access challenges. And we have had patients come to us from across county lines just trying to find a willing provider for the administration of this product. We know that not all providers may be comfortable with the buy and bill process of a high-cost rare disease medication. And so we have found that that is an unmet need. And so we've capitalized on that to make sure we have good access throughout our infusion geography, which is the four counties in South Florida that we operate in. And that has been really important for the overall management of those patients to make sure that they are stable with good disease control, not coming back to the hospitals with acute exacerbations, whether it is the ED visit or a full hospitalization.
So thank you, Jorge. That's actually important because and we'll talk more about that. I might have more questions for you. But before we get there, you mentioned a few instances where we have to think about it. And I think that's the point. We need to remind the physicians who see those patients, when do you think about PNH? So who do you think, like if you have a list, who do you think you would screen for PNH? And you did mention some of those, but we can like have it.
So I think the few populations, number one, aplastic anemia, MDS, that's a must.
So those anybody who you suspect aplastic
anemia and MDS.
Check for
them. They definitely can have clones that are substantial, and sometimes they're small clones that don't need treatment, but you can't diagnose something that you don't check for.
I'm going to stop you here. So if you find a small clone, you still need to follow up on that clone
definitely.
If you don't have improvement, because they can become significant what you need to treat, right?
Correct. It's important. First, you detect the clone, and then after you detect it, you follow those patients, because sometimes that clone is not evident or it's not
significant.
It is evident, but not significant. So, just on that line, you need to make sure that you check the clones in both erythrocytes and granulocytes, because sometimes the erythrocytes, have hemolysis. And hence the clones in those cells are less than say 20%. And then you very rarely I see in the granulocytes, it's about 50%. So you definitely need to make sure you check two cell lines, usually granulocytes and erythrocytes.
If you order the test, would they do that automatically or do you have to specify?
Most labs do it automatically.
Yeah.
They check both granulocytes and erythrocytes, but you definitely need to make sure that you look at the report.
So if you get the report and you don't see that, you ask for it. You
definitely.
Say, look, I need both. You only give me a result for
one. And usually the one that they give you is erythrocytes.
Yeah.
So
make sure they do that.
So they can underestimate the real clone size in those patients. So
because they might not have hemolysis, but they could have the other manifestation of disease. So I think that's the point. We don't want like just to focus on the hemolysis part, even though that's like the training and the education that most of us got. That may be changing now, but so we have to remember it's a systemic disease. You could have pulmonary manifestations, kidney manifestations, even cardiac sometimes, right?
Definitely. And I think another big categories, unexplained thrombosis. A 30-year-old who comes in because, she or he got a thrombosis, That is one patient population that we definitely underdiagnose PNH. And maybe 5 years later, like you suggested, they might have, hemolysis. And then we think about it then. So they went 5 years
Without being,
without being treated.
of course, you
So,
have to rule out the other
yeah,
more
of
common
course.
causes of, they have bacterial pyelitis or
Yeah, of
any,
course.
so after you rule out the
Yeah.
other common causes, then this is one of the things you think
Yeah.
about.
I order it in conjunction
In
with,
conjunction. Okay. It's a
yeah,
simple
so
test. It's
it's
not
a,
that
exactly,
expensive,
and it's
so
not expensive. It's on
compared with
per,
that, yeah.
it's on peripheral blood, just like your Factor V
Yeah.
Leiden or your Protein S. So
But
I'm
someone
just,
who's a woman who's been pregnant and had a clot after pregnancy, this is
yeah,
not someone you would, but
no,
someone who was like very healthy, active, and one day came with portal vein thrombosis
exactly,
or
and portal vein and then cerebral veins.
cerebral. Yeah, that's the
Cerebral
other thing. Doesn't
veins.
have to be, just in the body. It could be CNS
Exactly.
manifestations. Yeah.
Those are the two clots that you should think about, portal vein and cerebral drain, or intra-abdominal clots and cerebral clots in particular. Of course, they can present with DVTs and PEs, run-of-the-mill. Of course, you're going to think about your more
The
common
normal.
causes in
And then
English
you
patients.
mentioned something also that people may not even think about PNH, and that which is unexplained iron deficiency.
Yes.
So patient with iron deficiency anemia. Why do you think that?
So, I saw the other day a 20-something-year-old with unexplained iron deficiency, and it was a PNH in those patients. Of course, in celiac disease and other diseases are more common in a 20-year-old, but they were having classic PNH symptoms and hemoglobinuria, definitely
That's how
it.
they lose iron, basically. Okay.
Exactly, that's how they were losing iron. So it's not a common occurrence,
But it's something to think about.
but once again, these are the subset of populations that will take 5 years to diagnose,
Yeah.
because they'll get scopes, et cetera, and then one day they're going to be admitted in the hospital and they'll be having hemolysis,
Yeah.
and then they will have gross hemolysis, and
And then you
or
think about
then
it.
you
It's
think
too
about,
late. Yeah.
oh, they have a thrombosis.
Yeah.
And then you think about it. So
Yeah.
unexplained iron deficiency, and your Coombs negative hemolytic anemia panel, just like you order a G6PD
Yeah.
deficiency or pyruvate kinase deficiency,
Order the PNH.
you should order a PNH.
Yeah, it's a simple test. I think that's
Exactly.
the point. It's not like you're ordering something complicated.
Yeah. So in those patients, I order a hemolytic anemia ID. And then I order a PNH because it
Yeah.
covers mainly, your hereditary spherocytosis,
Right. Yeah.
all those things. And then
You
you order a
cover it.
PNH, you order a flow
Yeah.
cytometry.
Jorge, can you tell us a little bit about what the options of treatment for patients with the PNH? Because you mentioned some of those patients are diagnosed in the hospital, and so what are out there for treatment for PNH?
Well, this patient population, primarily we look at eculizumab and ravulizumab options on the acute setting. And then based on patient preference and other components, there may be other factors that other products that the patients may be on. I just wanted to add that our team is really focused on that journey of trying to find the patient and help with our hematologist in that journey. We're very interested in the potential role of decision support tools to really just help find that list of suspect patients. Because as we know, these patients are just, 9 to 13 in a million, and they can mask other disease states like anemia and other things, right? And so with decision support tools, which pharmacists have a lot of experience with, we can see certain readmission patterns as an example for patients that are just keep coming back to the hospital and they don't have good control of the disease. So that could be a potential signal that something else may be going on with them. I completely agree that we have a great opportunity when we look at aplastic anemia. And per guidelines, those patients should be tested. And I think that there is an opportunity. Pharmacists can help just retrospectively looking back at all of our patients that have aplastic anemia and make those recommendations for further testing. And we're also really good at understanding patients that may be on therapy but are not responding to therapy. And sometimes escalating that and bringing to the attention of the hematologist could be very helpful in terms of establishing further workup. So again, you know, through decision support tools, through what we're doing in the community with the infusion centers, just working closely with that hematologist is kind of key to make sure that we continue to provide good care to this subset of patients.
We couldn't. All right. So how about what options of treatment would you?
So I definitely agree with Dr. Garcia. You know, complement inhibition is usually awful. You know, the first treatment I think about. You know, first of all, you know, complement inhibition definitely has the most data in thrombosis. There's not a lot of long-term data with thrombosis. So I definitely agree with that. You know, most patients with complement inhibition, the intravascular hemolysis subsides. And the best data we have with anticoagulation after that is variable because, you know, a lot of these patients present with clots.
Right.
So sometimes you have to manage their clot after, for years you didn't know that they have a PNH, but once you diagnose them with PNH, then you have to try to, you know, in your mind come up with some sort of pathway, whether they need the anticoagulation, you know, for forever. So complement inhibition, and long-term complement inhibition definitely is important in these patients. And there's a lot of...
No, I just want to say, like, you know, because anticoagulation without complement inhibition may fail.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
That's not the only... Yeah. So you can still anticoagulate, but and that's one of the patients maybe you look for if they are failing
anticoagulation. Yeah. So, and then the question lies always is, after you start them on complement inhibition, can you take them off of anticoagulation?
Yeah.
And definitely there is a subset of population that you can take off anticoagulation. You know,
what options for complement inhibition do we have? We have eclusumab was the first one to come.
We have eclusumab, ravulizumab. You know, most patients would prevent like a every 2 month drug. So you know, in my practice, I favor ravulizumab because it's a you come in once every 2 months. As you know, when you start inhibition with any treatment, complement inhibition, you definitely need to monitor those patients within the first month. You know, I monitor them weekly.
Mm-hmm.
After I initiate complement.
What do you monitor?
I monitor CBC, CMP, retic count,
mm-hmm.
because LDH, of course. Mm-hmm. Their retic counts are going to continue to be elevated.
Okay.
When you start complement inhibition, it doesn't decrease the retic count. First of all, your retic count is important because that you're keeping up with the hemolysis. If you see people not reticking who have PNH, they probably have folate deficiency.
Yeah.
So you definitely need to supplement them with folate because folate is important. And that's another thing. Other than complement inhibition, they definitely need to be on folate. Your iron deficient patients need to be on iron, but the majority of patients who have PNH don't need iron supplementation. So you shouldn't be this.
Once you stop the
exactly,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And once you stop, but they still need folate,
yeah,
because you know you might have some extravascular hemolysis, etc. Mm-hmm. So I definitely, and you know, 1 milligram of folate, oral is, you know, water soluble. It's not going to harm any patient. Iron is definitely not a must. Pathway is important.
I think that's very important. Yes, Jorge, just 1 minute about treatment logistics and treatments in general.
Absolutely. So I think in the PNH space, we heavily rely on our hematology team to help us find that patient. We talked about many ways to make sure we get to those patients. There are more patients out there we need to get to and get there earlier. Once there is a diagnosis, you know, as pharmacists, we could be great partners, making sure that we can support the rest of that patient journey, whether that is through formulary access on the inpatient setting or the long continuum of therapy that those patients will require on the outpatient setting. It's that complement inhibition and making sure that we have a therapy selection that is going to be appropriate for that patient, that is going to give that patient good adherence so that we could have good handle of the disease and can help that patient stay healthy at home and not having to come back to the hospitals with acute exacerbations.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much for your time. I thank you all for joining us and for listening to us. I hope you find this helpful. Hope you all have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good day.